Notes and sophistries, my working day has just begun. 9 a.m., my blood's not pumping. Wonder which staffer's Nancy been dumping. Check that clock, thank God I'm almost done. Working 9 to 10, put total effort in it. That's my regiment, 60 solid working minutes as your president. I won't cut that any smaller. I get free rent and $200,000. White House staffers are real go-getters. Working in the room with the shredders and wild adventures, we are all engrossed. Scams and schemes and plots we're planning, like the days of Pat Buchanan. Believe what we are doing to the Post. Working 10 to 5 while our boss is busy napping. We're in overdrive, military moves were napping.
I don't think that I've ever seen such mischief makers.
For the sakes alive, here comes Howard Baker!
I'm gonna put a stop to their misbehavior. I'm gonna be the grand old party savior. I'll undo all that Donald Reagan did. If Reagan wants to wield his power, he's gotta put in that extra hour. These Oval Office naps I now forbid.
Working dawn to dusk,
I will keep you extra busy.
As a boss, your boss,
I will work it till you're dizzy.
Don't you think this rush, change of pace is kinda chancy? Can I take a break?
I better go ask Nancy.
Why should I show full devotion? A dead end job, I can't get a promotion. So I'll just keep on working 9 to 10.
Ships are sailing and on stormy seas. There's a Radio Free America just for you and me. The big radio station that's thinking up the air. The juice, let him spot the real nightmare. Say hi, I'm a diesel. Go by radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC calling over. Guards are coming to shut the pirates down. The don't believe in free speech. The FCC's in town. Their axles and their hammers, they're smashing all the beds. They want a little battle, but the war's not over yet. Say, hi, I'm a diesel. Come on, pirate radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC rolling over. What are they afraid of? That we might tell the truth. We might play something good and it wouldn't be a ghost. What we need is liberty, not those sticky laws. Freedom from the FCC and their money grubbing paws. Say, hi, I'm a diesel. Come on, pirate radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC calling the brave. Lots of rum. We'll wake them, walk the plank. We're having lots of fun. Say, hi, I'm a diesel. Come by radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC calling your brave. Hi, I'm a diesel. Come by radio. Land of the free and home of the brave. FCC calling your brave. Say, hi, I'm a diesel. Radio, I'm gonna bring it over the bridge.
96.3 Free Radio. And it's time for cut your hair and get a fucking job. This is Old Lady Scarves. We have a guest today. Sierra, want to say hello? Hello. Baby Greaser James is here, but I'm still unsure if we're going to hear from him today. Want to say hi, Baby Greaser? Second mic isn't working. You're going to have to join us over here, I'm afraid. Oh, no.
Hello there, folks.
I think Baby Greaser has some stuff to talk about a little later on, but still a little shy of the microphone. So, I came really prepared today. I stopped by the library about half an hour before my show to get some news and ended up waiting in quite a line and dealing with some very bizarre individuals. It was quite interesting. One of the women that was ahead of us that was on the computer was laughing hysterically about every 5 seconds. I don't know what was so funny, but I checked out some of what she was looking at, and one of the websites she was trying to get on was Get Them Out of the Library, They're Whores.com, as well as TeenageWasteland.com and DeadPresidents.com. She got something on Dead Presidents, and it was pretty interesting. She called me over. She said for me to come closer, and when I did, she started going off on me and asking us if we were there for the Carrie remake, which was really interesting because right after that, I read this article in the paper that commented that Stephen King had been hit by a van. I'm not sure when this happened, but I guess he was pretty seriously injured. He's okay, but he had a broken arm and some lacerations to his head. We were wondering if it might have been that Stephen King shot John Lennon van, but I don't know. They didn't have any details on that. So, I'm going to play you a song here while we get our shit together.
Why? We always can be counted on when there's a job to do. We serve our homeland day and night to keep it always free, and proudly wear our robes of white, protecting liberty.
Sure is fine because you're being redneck, white, red, chicken shit, motherfucker.
Why? American!
In the movies, Henry Fonda in The Wrong Man, Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, North by Northwest, Thin Blue Line, an innocent person, when they least expect it, falls into an unbelievable chain of events and finds themselves accused of a crime they could not possibly have committed. Every step in the justice system goes wrong. All seems hopeless as the camera rolls closer and closer to the death chamber until finally, at the very last minute, the authorities are proven wrong and the accused is set free to live happily ever after as the credits roll. After all, this is America, where these sort of nightmares do not happen. Because our justice system is fair. Our justice system works. Now imagine you are a respected, award-winning, and courageous journalist whose news reports are sometimes critical of a notoriously violent and corrupt police department. Suddenly, the nightmare happens to you. Shot through the liver at the scene of a crime. Instead of helping you, the cops beat you as you lie on the sidewalk and allegedly beat you again inside the hospital. Not in Haiti, not in China, but in the United States of America. When you wake up from surgery, the nightmare is still there. You are the one accused of what the corporate media tells us is the ultimate unforgivable sin, killing a police officer. You have no criminal record. Ballistics tests don't add up. There is plenty of evidence that you did not and could not commit this crime, but the nightmare just gets worse. Evidence that could clear you disappears. Witnesses disappear. A judge who has sentenced more than twice as many people to death than anyone else in the United States denies you a competent lawyer and denies you the right to defend yourself. Appeals are denied by the very judges who ruled the opposite way in almost identical cases. Not in Mexico, not in Nigeria, but in the United States of America. And unlike the movies, this time a headline-hungry governor salivates like a giggling crocodile, eager to put a black man to death with a stroke of a pen to hold up as a trophy to enhance his political career. Why is our government so hell-bent on killing Mumia Abu-Jamal? Why are they so afraid of him? Of his voice? Of his way with words? To the point where even a poem about him and the frightening government lawlessness in his case is banned from national public radio? Is it what he says about our country and ourselves, in words so powerful and eloquent that our children may one day study his now banned radio commentaries in school, the way some now study the last words of Bartolomeo Vanzetti, before he and Nicola Sacco were executed by the U.S. government in 1927 for a crime they did not commit? The real crime being they were anarchists. They were labor union activists. And if that's not enough, they were immigrants. What have we become? What are we letting ourselves become? This isn't the movies, this is what America has become. A 1995 FBI investigation leads to six Philadelphia police officers pleading guilty to assault, framing defendants, stealing money, lying to obtain search warrants, and more, resulting in more than 100 criminal convictions being overturned, yet still no new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And what of all the other wrongfully convicted human beings without Mumia's gifts for communication, who are caged like animals in our mushrooming prison industrial complex system, waiting to be killed by our government to satisfy Generation X acute America's sick thirst for human sacrifice and modern slavery? When Nigerian environmental and native rights activist Ken Sarawiwa was hanged on trumped-up murder charges, the Nigerian government and Shell Oil were condemned all over the world as outlaws. Now we are the outlaws of the world in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And as more and more wealth gets sucked upward by people who don't need it, and mass rage toward corporate America swells closer and closer to the boiling point, the official response is to keep the lid clamped on tighter and tighter and tighter through more and more police state actions, just like the ones we fought in World War II to eliminate from the face of the earth. If this is allowed to keep going, what has happened to Mumia Abu-Jamal could happen to other innocent people, like three guys in West Memphis, Arkansas, who were convicted of the brutal murders of three small children. One is on death row, the other two got life. The evidence used to convict them was they wore black clothing and listened to heavy metal. Free the West Memphis Three. If allowed to go far enough, this could happen to anyone. It could happen to me. It could happen to you.
There is a war being waged on America's poor. In social policy, poor mothers are targeted for criminal sanctions for acts, if committed by mothers of higher economic class, would merit treatment at the Betty Ford Center. In youth policy, governments hasten to close schools by building boot camps and prisons as their graduate schools. Xenophobic politicians hoist campaigns to the dark star of imprisonment for street beggars, further fattening the fortress economy. The only apparent solution to the scourge of homelessness is to build more and more prisons. In America's 90s, to be poor is not so much socioeconomic status as it is a serious character flaw, a defect of the spirit. Federal statistics tell a tale of loss and want so dreadful that Dickens, of A Tale of Two Cities fame, would cringe. Consider 7 million people homeless with less than $200 in monthly income. 37 million people, 14.5% of the nation's population, living below poverty levels. Of that number, 29% are African Americans, meaning over 10.6 million blacks living in poverty. Both wings of the ruling Republican Party try to outdo themselves in announcing new, ever more draconian measures to restrict, redress, restrain, and to eliminate the poor. One is reminded of the wry observation of French writer Anatole France, "The law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread." Already, U.S. manufacturers have fled to NAFTA-friendly Mexico, and only the Zapatista insurgency in Chiapas has slowed an emerging flood of Western capital. Outgunned in the industrial wars by Japan and Germany, the U.S. has embarked on a low-technology, low-skilled, high-employment scheme that exploits the poor, the stupid, and the slow via a boom in prison construction, America's sole growth industry. Increasingly, more and more Americans are guarding more and more American prisoners for more and more years, and this amidst the lowest crime rate in decades. No major political party has an answer to this social dilemma, short of cages and graves for the poor. The time is ripe for a new, broader, life-affirming vision that liberates, not represses, the poor who, after all, are the vast majority of this earth's people. Neither serpentine politics nor sterile economic theory, which treats them, people, as mere economic units, offer much hope, for the very politicians they vote for spit in their faces, while economists write them off as non-persons. It must come from the poor, a rebellion of the spirit that reaffirms their intrinsic human worth based upon who they are rather than what they possess. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are tuned to 96.3 Free Radio, Santa Cruz. Baby Greaser James and Old Lady Skullarms here today with Cut Your Hair and Get a Fucking Job, and we have a guest. Want to introduce yourself?
Big Bad Mama 2.
Watching too many of those cheesy TV movies lately, huh, Sierra? Big Bad Mama in the house with us today. So, as you could tell, that was Mumia Abu-Jamal commentary on the war on the poor. And right before that, Jello Biafra, a piece from his new spoken word album. And before that, I played Consolidated, Stop the War Against the Black Community and White American Male. I have a little bit of news about Mumia. We had heard a short time ago that he was having some medical problems. His ankles and wrists, his ankles and shins evidently had swollen and were discolored, and Pam Africa visited him recently and said that it was frightening to her. His condition was frightening to her. That's how bad it was. More recently, Leonard Wineglass visited him on death row at SCI Green, and he said that Mumia has been seen by a prison doctor, and I guess it was 2 minutes he got with the doctor, and he's wanting everyone to hold off on calling for outside medical attention until he gets the diagnosis or treatment or whatever. So that's what's going on with his medical condition currently. It's not as serious as we had feared when we first heard about it. He evidently doesn't have other symptoms other than the swelling and discoloration of the shins and ankles. He isn't exhausted and doesn't have the other symptoms of, say, diabetes or heart condition, which was what was feared. So we're still waiting to find out what exactly is going on with his health. There's a civil disobedience coming up that's being planned. On Saturday, July 3rd, the anniversary of Mumia's death sentence, international concern, friends and family of Mumia is calling for a civil disobedience at the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Also here in San Francisco, an Independence from Mumia Day legal procession will gather at the Federal Building at noon and proceed to Union Square and end with a direct action. They're hoping for at least 100 people to participate in this direct action and many more in the legal procession. In addition to the Independence for Mumia Day on July 3rd, we are building for a large action during the National Week of Actions for Mumia at the end of September and for an emergency response should Pennsylvania issue a death warrant for Mumia this summer. And if you want any more information on the civil disobedience that's coming up, you can call area code 415-431-3594, or you can email at fireworks@igc.org. There's one other thing. Abuja Mall supporters have called for a July 4th march. This is, I guess they're going to do a civil disobedience on July 3rd, and then the following day, July 4th, they're going to march. And on the West Coast, supporters will gather at the San Francisco Federal Building, Turk Street side, at noon for an Independence from Mumia Day parade, which will be followed by civil disobedience. To participate in civil disobedience or for more information, please come to the pre-action gathering this Saturday, June 19th at 5 p.m. at 362 Cap Street near 18th. Whoops, that was yesterday, wasn't it? Damn it. Well, I guess I'll just give you that number again, and if you're interested in doing civil disobedience on July 3rd, or 4th, or both, you can call 415-431-3594 or get on the internet, fireworks@igc.org. I believe there's something being planned here in Santa Cruz, too, for July 4th. It hasn't formulated yet, but the Santa Cruz Coalition of Free Mumia Abuja Mall is meeting tomorrow after in the evening at 6:30 p.m. at Loudon Nelson at Laurel Street Park, and we're going to discuss that. Some kind of action for the 4th of July here in Santa Cruz. And as far as I know, there was an execution that took place here in the U.S. in Alabama on the 18th, Friday, June 18th, 1999. And I have an urgent action here that I'd like to read. It's not very long. I'd like to let you guys know about this because there's somebody executed in this country pretty much about once a week and we really don't hear about it. I know I didn't read about this in the paper. I looked on the internet today. I got on the Amnesty website and I couldn't find out if this execution had actually happened or not, even though I was looking to try to find out whether or not they'd actually executed Brian Baldwin. I was unable to find that out, so I don't know if that was just because I'm not looking in the right place or what, but I know we don't really hear about executions that go on, so I'm just going to read this urgent action here. Brian Baldwin is scheduled to die in the electric chair June 18, 1999 in Alabama, and I have no reason to think he wasn't executed, so. According to his clemency petition, there is new evidence that he may not have committed the crime for which he was sentenced to death at a 1977 trial infected with racism. Brian Baldwin, who was black and was 18 at the time of the crime, was convicted of the March 1977 abduction, robbery, and murder of a 16-year-old white girl, Naomi Rowland. His accused, his co-accused, 19-year-old Edward Horsley, also black, was tried separately and executed in 1996. According to Baldwin's clemency petition, Horsley signed a statement in 1985 that Baldwin, quote, was not present at any point before or after the murder of Naomi occurred. In fact, he was not even aware that she had been killed until after we were arrested and the dead body was recovered that night in Monroeville, unquote. Just before his execution, Horsley reportedly said, quote, no one else is responsible. At Brian Baldwin's trial, which lasted a day and a half, the main evidence against him was a confession he gave to Wilcox County Police. Baldwin stated at the trial that they had made this confession out of fear. Quote, they told me that if I didn't confess, they were going to hang me, shoot me, beat me up. Then they took handcuffs and handcuffed me to a bar and took an electric stick, the thing you poke cows with, and poked me with that, unquote. He said that one of the officers had, quote, opened his coat and put his hand on his pistol and started pulling it out and asking me if I was going to sign a statement, so I signed it, unquote. The judge allowed Baldwin's confession to be used as evidence against him. In a recent affidavit of former Wilcox County police officer in 1977, the only African-American deputy in the country, in the county, stated that Baldwin was, quote, beaten and physically mistreated during interrogation and that there was an electric cattle prod at Wilcox County Jail at the time. Baldwin's current lawyers claim to have located former inmates who remember bruises and other injuries on Baldwin's body after his interrogation. The prosecution reportedly failed to disclose the defense expert evidence that Baldwin's clothing and shoes, unlike Horsley's, had no blood on them. A forensic expert has recently stated that the death blow to Naomi Rowland by a hatchet was most probably delivered by a left-handed person. Brian Baldwin is right-handed. Horsley, who had a cut on his thumb when he was arrested, was left-handed. As in Horsley's case, Brian Baldwin was tried in Monroe County Circuit Court before an all-white jury after the prosecutor had used 11 of his peremptory challenges, the right to exclude jurors without giving reasons, to exclude the only 11 African-Americans in the jury pool. The judge did not intervene, and the defense attorney did not object. According to Baldwin's petition clemency petition during the trial, both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer referred to Baldwin as, quote, boy, a racially derogatory term. In 1988, an African-American man, Walter McMillan, was sentenced to death in Monroe County Circuit Court. He faced the same prosecutor and judge as Baldwin had. The judge sentenced McMillan to death after overriding the jury's recommendation for life, following a day-and-a-half-long trial marked by racism. McMillan was released in 1993 after being found to have been wrongfully convicted of the murder of a white woman. In another case in 1993, an Alabama appeals court found a prima facie case of racial discrimination in the Monroe County Circuit Court's grand jury selection process between 1977 and 1991. On June 11, 1999, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter wrote to the governor of Alabama urging that Baldwin's sentence be commuted. This request is based upon my understanding of the facts and the records which indicate that, one, there were clear reasons to question his culpability in the murder, and two, there was no doubt that racial prejudice was a significant factor both in his trial and in his death sentencing. Brian Baldwin lived in a hotel from the age of 13 because he and his father did not get along. He was expelled from school at 16. At the time of his trial, he had not seen his family for 3 years. During more than 2 decades on death row, Brian Baldwin has obtained his high school diploma, successfully completed the legal assistant paralegal curriculum of the Blackstone School of Law. He edits an abolitionist newsletter on Wings of Hope mailed across the U.S. and abroad, and that was an Amnesty International urgent action that I actually only got the day before he was scheduled to be executed, which was June 18th, 1999. And like I said, I have no reason to believe that he was not executed in Alabama on Friday. If anyone knows anything about this case, I'd appreciate if you'd call in, let us know if you've heard that he was in fact executed. I'm going to play a song and come back and talk a little bit more about the death penalty. I want to talk a little bit about Kevin Cooper's case. I'm actually going to have his advocate, Jody Kramer, soon come on the show and talk about his case. But I'd like to mention thing or two about Kevin's case and read a couple statistics. Then Jim has some news too, and we also have a couple announcements, but I'm going to play a song right now. If I can get this thing to work. Play, piece of shit.
keeps their purpose in mind. I want somebody who has a tortured soul. Some of the time. I want somebody who will either put out for me or put me out of my misery. Or maybe just put out all the words and make me go, you know, I never heard it put that way. Make me go, what did you just say?
Tune to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. Of course, I played the wrong song, but I hope you enjoyed it anyway. Here, take the phone, Jimmy. Baby Greaser James is with me, and she has some news for us. But first, I'm going to talk some more. I'm sure you're really excited that I'm about to talk more. I wanted to read you a few facts about the death penalty. Fact: it costs more to execute a person than to keep him or her in prison for life. A New York study revealed it costs $2.8 million to try an indigent capital defendant through the first stage of appeals, more than twice the cost of life imprisonment. The study concluded that it would cost about $850,000 to keep an inmate in prison for 40 years. In 1988, the Sacramento Bee reported that California spends at least $1 million to prosecute each death penalty case at both the trial and appellate levels. One case has already cost more than $5 million. The Sacramento Bee reported that taxpayers could save $90 million per year if the death penalty were abolished. Quote, it now costs the state much more to attempt to execute someone than to lock the person up for life without parole. Can California, which faces massive budget cuts in education, social services, and other desperately needed programs, afford to waste millions of dollars on state killing? Myth: the death penalty deters crime. Fact: scientific studies have failed to conclusively prove that executions deter people from committing crime. According to Dr. Ernst van den Hoog, a well-known scholar in favor of the death penalty, one cannot claim that it has been proven statistically that the death penalty does deter more than alternative penalties, unquote. Former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall has said, quote, the death penalty is no more effective a deterrent than life imprisonment, unquote. People often kill when under great emotional stress or under the influence of drugs or alcohol, times when they are not thinking about the consequences. A person who plans a crime does not expect to get caught. Myth: to be safe, we must execute murderers. Fact: we all want to be safe from crime, but executions won't shield society from the fear of random violence that fuels the death penalty debate. Killing human beings won't make us safer. It brutalizes everyone when the state kills in our name. Frequently, violent crime increases right after a highly publicized execution. Myth. No alternative exists to the death penalty. Fact. California judges have the option of sentencing convicted capital murderers to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Since 1978, more than 1,800 people have received this alternate sentence, and not one has ever been released. The public can be assured that those who commit atrocious murders and receive this sentence will never be free again. A recent field poll showed support for the death penalty plummeted when alternative sentencing is available. Just 29% favored death over life without parole, plus requiring the defendant to work in prison and give part of his or her earnings as restitution to the families of the victims. Executions do nothing to treat the causes of violent crime. By spending limited tax dollars on the death penalty, we are actually making our lives less safe by neglecting services that can stop crime before it starts: education, health care, law enforcement, proper child rearing, and drug and alcohol abuse prevention. State killing is an empty ritual with no proven benefits. Too many politicians support the death penalty in order to appear tough on crime. This lethal window dressing merely hides their inability to address complex social issues that might prevent crime. And we have a quote here from Coretta Scott King. Justice is never advanced in the taking of human life. Morality is never upheld by legalizing murder. There's some little facts in here. I'm not going to read them all. But this is from Death Penalty Focus of California. And their website is www.deathpenalty.org. And they have an office in San Francisco as well. So I encourage you to check out, to learn more about the death penalty, because people are executed in this country about once a week. There have been 500 people executed since 1977 when they reinstated the death penalty. And also since then, 76 people have been exonerated, found innocent, removed from death row. Most recently, 3 people, I think it was in Illinois, and one of those guys, at least one of them was freed by a group, I think it was from New York State. It was a college in New York. These people had a project called the Innocence Project, and these students just looked into this guy's case and found him innocent, and he'd been on death row for, I think, easily over 10 years. I think it was like 14 years or something. He had come within hours of being executed, too, previous to that. In addition, 23 people that were executed were proven innocent after they were executed. You know, that does a lot of good. Well, let me see here. I think I'm going to play that song that I didn't play right the first time for you, and then come back with some news from Baby Greaser James.
Standing at the
guess now I'm going home. So let he amongst you cast the first. Everyone just does their job.